Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome, everyone, again to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am, of course, your host, John Schmidt. And again today, as most Mondays for the last 3 years, I'll be taking us out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures, those that I always like to say are rich with the essence of constant renewal. Well, it is great to be back. I am coming to you today from the rather rarefied air of the Colorado Rockies here in the U.S. I am amidst one of the three retreats I do during the year, another nine-day one here this time, devoted in group to the inner path of self-realization, the up-close and personal dimension that I point to each week, and certainly that we practice through the year and bring attention to throughout the through line of Zoomed. And I must say, it's always a pleasure to engage Zoomed from the here and now view that I have looking out the window in front of me, the snow-capped mountain peaks, albeit a little bit more sparse than normal. But the grandeur of life, the immense beauty, and the boundless unity that you feel here that gets so richly reflected from the high peaks here in Colorado is simply stunning. It's rather blissful. The sense of vastness of the being really seems to be pervading everything. It actually feels that way in my own sense of things to hear, including the differentiation of my own soul and this amazing singular harmonic that flows out of this unity. So it's great to be here with you. And as we get started today, I am delighted, actually, with the timing and the opportunity to have a guest with us that I think mirrors richly this vast unity through both the practice, the study, and the wisdom of his own path and bringing to life in the book we'll talk about and actualizing the wisdom of his perspectives in a way through the book that we'll talk about today and his work that is very, very rich and worthy of our consideration. Our guest today is Rajiv Malhotra, that is R-A-J-I-V-M-A-L-H-O-T-R-A, the author of the book Being Different, An Indian Challenge to Western Universalism. And I think before I even get there too much and even introduce Rajiv more fully, perhaps I need to make a little bit of a connecting the dots introduction to this, because I feel like this book and where Rajiv is coming from is right on track where we have been this year. If you recall, we started the year with emphasis on objectivity, on recognizing bias, on the sense of inner knowing that might be very clear, very important, and how as leaders we are best advised to be very clear from multiple and unbiased perspectives about what is really going on. And I think with this ground, this up-close and personal base that we continued to point to this year, we turned our attentions from that base to a larger, predominantly sort of the look at our Western system at play in the world, and in particular the nature of crony capitalism that's consuming our lives, the economic and the financial ways and means of it, and how this system is very reflective in some ways of an increasingly dominating force over ourselves and much of the world. We focused on the system, the tilt of the system at play, a massive tilt, as I even said last week, on the pinball game of life that we're living, that's actually bringing with it plenty for some and struggle for many. And we have been highlighting, I think, for some time, the nature of this system as a through line to Zoomed. And more recently, we've even been talking about manifestations of it, that even beyond the tangible wars of the world, we've been talking about the currency wars at play that are underpinning this debt-laden future and the pathways that may lead us into it. But what we haven't been doing as richly has been looking more definitively at the cultural dimensions that mirror and backdrop this system. The cultural dimensions that Rajiv will even speak to us about over the course of our time together about Western universalism and how it might be understood and contrasted with other cultures, with other civilizations, other ways of living and being. And folks, I think it's really important for us all, and especially in the West, to understand with some objective clarity the water that we're swimming in, that it oftentimes is so transparent to us that it's important for us to clearly differentiate it. And that's where Rajiv comes in today. That's where the book Being Different, I think, is so important to us. And by way of a little more introduction, Rajiv is an American researcher, writer, speaker, and public intellectual on the current affairs as they relate to what we're talking about here. Civilizations, cross-cultural encounters, religion and science as they are manifested. And being different really is, folks, the results of 40 years of Rajiv's practice under several Indian masters, his combined serious study of Western philosophical systems and histories, as well as the Indian history and philosophy. He's a scientist by training. He brings that objective view that's so clearly distinct in terms of what we've been looking at. And now, as well with that, he is the full-time founder and director of the Infinity Foundation in Princeton, New Jersey. He's also involved in many other things. He's the chairman of the Board of Governors at the Center for Indic Studies at the University of Massachusetts. Rajiv, great to have you with us. I think this conversation is so in tune.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Maybe, Rajiv, start with us today a little bit about your background and maybe even about the approach to the book, because I think it's, as I was saying before we got on, it's different than just a critique of systems. It's, or at the best and at the worst, is bashing as many things go on. It really has an understanding perspective that's unique. Maybe you can start us a little bit on both of those dimensions.
Sure, would love to. You know, my own life is a dual journey, an Indian journey, and also a very Western journey. Raised in India, born and raised in India till the age of 20, and then I migrated to the United States, which was about 40 years ago. I had a dharmic, spiritual upbringing in the home and in my own personal life, through a lot of readings, through a lot of journeys, through a lot of meditations. And at the same time, my external life was very Westernized. I was raised in a very Westernized school system, extremely Westernized college, a very prestigious college in India. My father was an engineer, worked in a multinational, Western multinational. My mother, a physician. You know, she's now 87. And so they were both very rational, scientific, modern, what would be considered progressive by Western standards. So I had both kinds of influences. And then when I came to the West, the tendency was, due to the, you know, environment, due to the opportunities, I really got into the Western side of my own being for many years. And this included not only higher education, but in physics and computer science, but also a corporate career, very successful corporate career, then became a management consultant to some big companies, AT&T, people like that, and then became an entrepreneur and started my own ventures. So I've had my fill of the Western lifestyle, the materialism, accumulation of wealth, living the good life. I've had that. And at the same time, the inner side of me had this quest for something deeper. And then in the mid-90s, when I was 44 years old, came a transformation when I decided that I'll pursue my own inner journey and give up, a career, business, wealth accumulation, income generation, and I did that permanently and never looked back. So I've kind of had both the spiritual journey and also the what in the West would be considered a material, economic, external, extroverted type of career and profession.
And Rajiv,
I'm therefore a product of the West and the East.
Did it really launch that inner journey for you?
Well, the inner journey started early in India, and there were times when it would be more intense than others, but it never really left me. And then I always felt that once I have achieved a certain financial security, when I have the luxury of free time, I want to be able to just give that up and devote enough of my life, devote all of my life thereafter, for higher purposes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most of my friends felt I was a bit crazy leaving at the peak of my success, because there's no end to success in this system, and most of my Indian-American friends who are far wealthier than me feel like, you know, they just want to keep continuing on that same course. Because I think there's a tendency to be addicted to success. There's also a tendency, because one has missed out on the joy of an inner journey. And unless you have tasted that joy of the inner journey, you won't know why someone should give up this whole external success in order to pursue a higher purpose.
Yes.
But that was the gift I had as a child and in my teenage years. And so that is what pulled me back. And that is, and so, you know, I'm not an orthodox, you know, person in terms of Indian spirituality. I'm very westernized in terms of, my mental structure. And at the same time, I'm extremely deeply spiritual. And, my passion is to examine both of these, the gaze at each one of these from the other's point of view, so I can look at through the Western spectacles. I can look at the old traditions of Dharma from India, and I can wear the Dharma lenses and look at the West. I'm able to do both, and I also feel comfortable in both places. I go to India 3 or 4 times every year. For the last 40 years, I've been doing that. And I feel whenever I'm there, I feel very comfortable there. And whenever I'm here, I feel very comfortable here.
Rajiv, that's great. That's a wonderful opening, I think, to give us at least a better sense of you and sort of an orientation of where being different comes out. I hear the music in our ears there before we launch into much more, because there's a lot we can cover here and love to cover. Maybe we'll take a short break. Come back, and I'd like to really start a little bit more about being different and what is different, and start to build a foundation and a platform for that, so our listening audience will get a better sense of the path and the through line of where we go. But folks, let's take a short break. Let's come back in a moment. You're on Zoomed. Rajiv is with us today. Thanks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership, capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.
It's all Arizona, all over the world. If you're a local Arizona high school sports fan, or if you're a transplanted fan somewhere else in the world, have we got a show for you. The first internet sports radio talk show focusing solely on high school sports is The Coach's Corner with Scott Lovely. Tune in to talk about your favorite teams, players, or coaches. It's 100% Arizona high school sports coverage and a little bit more. Tune in Mondays at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern, to the Voice America Sports Channel.
There's a course offered on Seventh Wave Network that you never saw offered in college. One that provides information on how to transform ancient wisdom teachings into everyday life. You'll learn how to create from your spirit and explore the world with all of your senses. Participation is encouraged. Enroll in Spirituality 101, the course you can't afford to miss, with your host, Reverend Norma. Classes in session every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time, in your favorite classroom, Seventh Wave Network. When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back today, Rajiv Malhotra, Being Different, his book, An Indian Challenge to Western Universalism, suggested we would come back and start to pick up with some background on it. But, Rajiv, we were talking at a break. Maybe a place to start is some of your experience here in America, and particularly your sense of the culture. You've used the term Western Universalism. Maybe build a picture around that so we might understand that and what's to give with it in terms of understanding and how it might be even be expressed and being exported around the world.
Sure. In my corporate life, in my business life, I came across Americans of all types, all strata, highly educated types, and I felt that they were wonderful people. However, I felt that they were making a certain assumption that their ancestral history, the Western history and Western philosophy, Western religious life, the Western ideas of aesthetics and morality and values were universal, or at least they ought to be universal, that there's a sense of the West is ahead of everybody else, has always been. There's a sense of superiority built into it, and a kind of patronizing attitude towards non-Westerners that we are helping them become like us. There is the evangelical side, which makes a very explicit case that this is the only way that everybody else should convert to Christianity. And then there is the secular enlightenment version of it, which doesn't use God explicitly, but still has this idea that the Western notion of progress and rationality and science and development is sort of the ultimate, and everybody ought to come on board. So I saw this in my experiences with people, implicit. I mean, they hadn't sort of necessarily thought about it in this way, but it was unconsciously projected by them. And then when my kids, both my son and daughter, are born and raised in the United States, they are in their mid-20s in grad school, I saw the entire education system from kindergarten on geared towards this type of education, which was very sort of Western-centric. And it started occurring to me that and I coined the term Western Universalism to refer to this, and it started occurring to me that the problem with Western Universalism is not only for the non-Westerners who are at the receiving side of all this, but also for Americans themselves, because they could become prisoners of a certain limited worldview, and that may or may not always be in every respect the best alternative that there is. And I also started realizing that the composition of this country is changing. It's less European in origin and becoming more, you know, Hispanic and Asian, not only in the ethnography of the population, the demographics, but also its trade, its future. So given all of this, I felt I ought to wear my Indian lens, my lens from being raised in the Dharmic tradition, and look at the United States very honestly and very candidly, and offer a different perspective.
Well, I love that. And maybe you can say a little bit more, Rajiv, about how you would describe the worldview, the Western worldview, and how that's expressed then and inculcated in many respects through the education so that it sort of pervades the young and it's a self-sustaining system. Maybe you can differentiate that and maybe differentiate it in some ways too to the culture, the Indian culture that you're so familiar with.
Yes. You know, one of the interesting things is that the West, in fact, and quite a few Western scholars are now writing books, but just a few such books are out there, are discovering the amount of appropriation or inputs, borrowings, that the Europeans did from the Indian Dharmic traditions was absolutely amazing. In the 15th century, a whole lot of Westerners were learning Buddhism from their encounters in Japan and the Far East and and Buddhism being a sort of an export from India, it was an indirect, you know, assimilation of many Indian ideas. And then since the time of Vasco da Gama, who came to India, and the missionaries came all the way to the British colonial period, there has been a huge amount of, importation of Indian knowledge into the Enlightenment. And yet, the Greek appropriation is given credibility, is valorized, is taught in schools and colleges as part of our great heritage, but not the Indian side of the appropriation and the Indian side of the influence, which some people are now beginning to argue was perhaps even more profound than the Greek influence. A huge amount of mathematics came from India into Europe. A huge amount of astronomy, medicine, a lot of technologies like textiles and steel went into the Industrial Revolution of England. A lot of spiritual ideas and religious ideas came. And yet, you know, when Americans see themselves, they have no problem. In fact, they are very proud of all the inputs from Greece, but the inputs from India are never taught. And when pointed out, there's a denial, and when one has, faced the burden of proof properly and supplied the evidence, then there is a sort of dismissal or some kind of reluctance to deal with the extent to which what we call the West is a product of non-Western inputs as well. So this is something interesting I found.
The Western identity feels
embarrassed almost to admit the Asian inputs, whereas it has no such embarrassment admitting the Greek input.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you can differentiate it a little bit more, though, about the Greek input and how you would characterize the modern West and what is actually not even included or what's sort of diminished relative to the Indian tradition and the wealth of wisdom and perspective that has subtly pervaded it but not given attention to it.
Sure. One of the terms I've coined in this book, and I've coined several like the Western Universalism, which I explained, a term I've coined is I call history-centrism. And history-centrism is something which characterizes the West in a very dramatic way and contrasted with the Indian idea of selfhood. By history-centrism, I mean this notion that the higher truth is only available to us through some historical episodes which were very unique, absolute, for instance, Jesus, and that has to do with the nature of original sin. And therefore, Jesus has to have virgin birth so that he's not born a sinner. Otherwise, if he would be progeny of Adam and Eve, he too would be born a sinner and not able to help the rest of us. So that particular edict in the Nicene Creed is very central. And then the whole story of, his crucifixion and how it leads to salvation and so on. The historicity of a single episode and a single event is so strong, strongly imprinted in the Western mind. And even when the Enlightenment came and sort of clipped the power of the church to some extent and brought in the secular dimension, the idea of historicity was still projected even onto that secular dimension. The idea, Hegel's idea of a linear, like a train going through history and West is the engine driving the rest of them along. So the West sees higher truths through a kind of historical template. And in India, you know...
But also, let me stop on that. It's seeing the truth also external to the individual as well. Is that correct?
That is correct. Because history is that which happened to someone other than me. It happened to God. God, because of the human separation from God in the Orthodox, in the conventional view of Christianity, I know it's being questioned now, but in the conventional view of Christianity, from Judaism, based on Judaism, The separation of man and God requires an intermediary, a prophet, to come and deliver this message, because the Jesus experience is not assumed to be available to you and me. We are not the same essence as Jesus in the sense that we could have all of that knowledge personally. And so the historicity of what somebody else experienced is very absolute. It's very necessary. And if we lose that historicity, we really don't have any way to replicate that experience ourselves. And this means that not only am I relying on historicity, but by definition, the historicity is of another person in another culture, in another geography. And so my path has to go through that. It has to go through another time, place, and other people external to myself. Now, in the Indian tradition, if you go to a yoga class, I've never seen a yoga class where they start by saying, let's vouch for the historicity of Patanjali. Patanjali was teaching us these things, and therefore we believe in them, and because we believe in him. The personal life of, a rishi or a yogi is irrelevant. It is irrelevant whether you believe in Patanjali as a historical person. The effect of yoga will be the same anyway. The same is true in Buddhism. If you do not believe in the historicity of Buddha, the Eightfold Path will still work on you exactly the same way. Because Buddha himself said he's not the first, he's not the last, he's not bringing any covenants, he's not a prophet bringing any message. He's more like a scientist who's discovering a certain truth about the nature of the self. And this is available for every human being to discover for themselves. So I think that the dharmic approach to spirituality, which is based on the assumption that we are all eternally divine, we are all born divine and complete and able to discover that truth within ourselves. This is more like modern science. In modern science, to know gravitational laws of Newton, you don't have to know anything about Newton's life. You don't even have to believe that he existed, or if he existed, it might have been a different set of circumstances. His biography may be all wrong. You can actually discard or refute all facts about Newton's personal biography, and it will make no difference to you as a physicist in understanding Newtonian laws, because he didn't bring any change in covenants. He merely discovered what was always there. And so also Einstein, and so also every discoverer. Now, the rishis in Hinduism, as in the case of Buddha, they never claim that they are bringing a truth which was previously not available. They never claim that they are the first to have discovered it or the last to have discovered it. They always said that this same truth has been eternal, and it is available to everybody, and they are just having experienced it for themselves. They would like to share it with other people. Now, this changes the status of history. There's a huge contrast in the status of history between the two traditions.
And so let me just stop you there, Rajiv. I could hear the music in the background, and I want to really pick up on this some more, because part of what I was leading into the show about the way we came into the year, about being objective and understanding, I was actually making the distinction, and have been through this year, about the difference between believing and knowing, the direct knowing and believing, and I'd like to come back and pick up on that and get your really take on that a little bit more as a stepping stone on this and our connection back to leadership. But folks, let's take a short break. Quick one here on Voice America. We'll be back in a moment with Zoomed Rajiv Malhotra and Being Different. Come back in a moment. Thanks.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
Zoomed Leadership is sponsored in part by Cosmos Journal, the journal for world citizens creating the new civilization. More than just a publication, Cosmos is committed to informing, inspiring, and engaging the world in the transition to an emerging, sustainable, just, and compassionate global culture and civilization that works for all.
For over 10 years, Cosmos has been a leading voice that tracks the deep systemic transformations already occurring at the margins of society as our institutions prove unable to serve the needs of the times. Published twice a year in print and digital, Cosmos includes leading-edge articles from social change leaders on the global commons, people power, global governance, new economics, collective intelligence, and cultivating the self. The impact of these paradigm-changing ideas is enhanced through stunning visuals and photographic stories that motivate to action. Start exploring Cosmos Journal and continue opening your perspectives about leadership and the emerging great transition at cosmosjournal.org. Join the Cosmos Leaders of Change and make a difference today.
These days, everyone is looking for information on staying young, healthy, and fit. The Voice America Health and Wellness Network is here to help you on your quest to better health and a better you. We talk about everything from diet, fitness, and aging to substance abuse, personal growth, mental health, and much more. Learn from our experts who cover health and wellness from traditional and holistic perspectives. Tune in to the Voice America Health and Wellness Network. Healthy living starts here.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's avastoneconsulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, rich perspective, Rajiv. Well articulated, I think a beautiful sort of a through line for us, I think, is the continuity. But go back for a minute. I was pointing before the break to this distinction that I've been making about direct knowing versus believing and some of that parallel and contrast that you're describing about the cultures. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think if you assume the Indian starting point, the axiom that the self is not a different essence from the ultimate reality or the divine, is not a fallen sinner, is actually originally divine rather than original sinner, then the journey is more an internal journey. The journey is a journey of self-discovery, self-realization, rather than reading the history of what somebody else has done. The history of what somebody else has done can inspire me to do it for myself. But I cannot just by belief that so-and-so did this yoga asana and therefore he got this benefit, and by believing it, I'll get that benefit. It doesn't work that way. I have to go through this journey by myself. I have to go within. And other exemplars in history can act as role models and inspire me and act as signposts, and that's wonderful. But ultimately, I have to transcend that historicity and not use the history as something I can grasp and turn it into bondage of history and dependency upon history. This freedom from history. One of the earlier versions of this, I think even in the current version of this book, I have yoga as freedom from history. Yoga versus history. Because yoga is here and now, and it's about myself. And history is not here and now, it's about something else and not about myself. These are very different. And what makes this difference particularly significant is that to have an intermediary like the church, one requires a huge emphasis on history, because the church then becomes the distributor, the franchisor, the disseminator of that knowledge, which you don't have access to on your own. And therefore, the result of this history-centrism and empowerment of the church as the intermediary between man and God meant that most of the mystics in the Western tradition were persecuted rather than honored and encouraged to follow, to create lineages. Whereas in the Indian system, if a person claimed self-realization, you know, the public would rather follow such a person than any institution, because the institution is not necessarily considered, in direct contact with the ultimate reality, whereas this self-realized person is. So the public support for mystics and realized beings, and the king's support, the king would, become a follower of such people, led to multi-generational lineages forming of these kinds of mystical or spiritual exemplars. And you have these very ancient lineages where somebody has achieved a state of enlightenment, and through their meditation practice, they go and initiate some disciples, then those disciples achieve it, then those disciples continue it. So multi-generational, what in medicine would be called longitudinal studies, these result only in a civilization which has actually encouraged this. The West also had its mystics, but they were not encouraged the same way. So it did not result in rigor. It did not result in peer reviews for validation. And it did not result in such a huge plethora of meditational techniques as you will find in the Dharmic traditions. So I would say that the inner journey and the self-actualization leads to, yogis and living masters as the exemplars, and you replicate, try and replicate and aspire that same experience in yourself. Whereas the history centrism leads to powerful intermediate institutions that are going to disseminate that, and then there's a conflict between the two. And this is why mystics have always been considered suspect by the church. And, you know, it's very interesting that to be a saint, to be ordained a saint and canonized a saint by the church, you have to be dead. There are no living saints. You have to be dead. It used to be dead for 5 years. Now I think it's sometimes less than that. Because, you know, politically, if a living person were acknowledged as the saint, then people would rather go to the living person and perhaps abandon the institution. And so there is a power struggle between, you know, the two models. Somehow in the West, the model of centralization, institutional power and authority has predominated. And in India, the other model of people going their own way and following the guru they came across, and there is no real one authority that is centralized that tells you, you know, and has any authority, police power or power to throw you out or and so on. That these are the two models that are quite different, therefore the civilizations that have resulted are quite different.
Well, I think that builds on, Rajiv, part of our conversation where we've been having it, and what you're distinguishing here from an individual and an individual leader standpoint is the direct access, the direct knowing of reality versus someone, an institution or someone acknowledged to be the head of something, having the answers and access to reality. That's a big difference, and it really plays out differently in the way that the political realm is manifesting and in organizations is manifesting. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that from the organizational side, and the characteristics that come out of this less direct knowing, a belief-based system in the West, the history centrism in its approach and its influence on organizations, and contrast that with India and much more of this embodied internal direct experience of reality and how that's reflected that way.
Yeah, you know, the societies actually reflect this. It's very interesting, and I bring this out, I believe it's chapter 4, where I talk about order and chaos, and I show that a huge complexity is found in Indian society, in Indian thought, in Indian music, in Indian cuisine, in Indian iconography, and all sorts of things as compared to the West. There are philosophical reasons for all this. The West being history-centric and coupled with, a correlate of history-centrism being a strong authority of an institution, it invented some wonderful things also. The West invented the modern corporate structure. The first multinational is probably the Vatican. And they had, before the British East India Company, which is considered a model for modern multinationals, the British East India Company and the Dutch East India Company, before that were the Knights Templar. They were also sort of a multinational within the church. So the Western mind developed collective kind of organization, centralized authority, and how to resolve things with bylaws and with resolutions and stuff like that. So the Indian equivalent was it was almost something Westerners might think of as anarchy, in the sense that if I can go my own way, the way Buddha was an anarchist, in a sense. He kind of went his own way to discover his truth and recommended that everybody should do that. Completely decentralized, following one's own inner voice and inner intuition and experience, is quite antithetical to corporate obedience and rules and normative ethics. It's very contextual. Each person has their own context. So the highest form of dharma is called Svadharma, S-V-A, Svadharma, which literally means my dharma. It's sort of like on the computer you have, my documents and my favorite websites, which is highly personalized to you. Here is a model which says the dharma is highly individualized, because your circumstances, your predispositions, your karma from previous lives are very individual and very particular, and you should be following that dharma for yourself.
And Rajiv, I hear the background and the music here, and I know we were a little long on the last segment. Let's take a short break and come back here, because I'd like to pick up on this a little bit more about the ground bed has been laid, and I think you have the through line for how, in fact, we have institutions with the power that we have and a power over orientation to corporate bureaucracy. I'd like to get some perspectives on that and about how do we actually, from your sense of things at this point, actually, how do we begin to turn that around given the power in that structure? But let's take a short break, folks. Come back. We may have to continue this with another show. We've got so many places to go with Rajiv here. Let's take a break. Come back for the last segment here in a moment. Thanks.
Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network.
Are you tired of the government squandering your tax dollars on bailouts and overpaid bureaucrats? On Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Mike Beitler and his guests explain why big government regulations are the problem and innovative businesses and free markets are the solution. Listen to Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Network.
Think of the world 50 years ago. Now think of this same world and how it'll be 50 years from now. Did you know that if the world's population continues to grow at its current rate, our children and grandchildren will only have 25% of the resources per capita that our parents and grandparents had? We must preserve the foundation of a quality standard of living. That foundation starts with Go Green Radio. Join your host, Jill Buck, for Go Green Radio every Friday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America.
Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business.
You're listening to Zoom Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, Roger, back here. As I was really serious before, I think we have so many places to go here, so much to cover, short period of time in the last segment, but let's pick up on this. So maybe we can bridge, maybe we can't go all of where I was talking about, but there is out of the West then much more of this power-centered sort of a domination separateness as we've had, and it has an influence on organizations and what's happened. Say a little bit more about that and what's been happening in India in relation to that that's different in the U.S.
Well, you know, in India, the latest this economic boom over the last decade or so, which people hear about, you know, what Americans should know, which I think most don't know and don't appreciate, is that hardly 5% of India's workforce are organized corporate employees or government employees.
Say that again. You said 5%?
Hardly 5% work for a large enterprise, be it government or be it private enterprise, which is quite the opposite as in the case of China, where there are large organized industries owned by, you know, in a corporate structure, which is typically People's Republic Army owned or some other entity, but people are working for someone else most of the time. What would be a W-2 worker in the United States getting a W-2 payroll? In India, 95% or more are self-employed or organized in very small groups. And this is an absolutely amazing statistic. And also, when you look at the where the, a lot of the prosperity is coming, it's these very tiny self-organized groups that are networked with each other. So there would be a whole network of individual entrepreneurs, and I do something and supply to you, and I'm one of hundreds that are sort of suppliers to you, and then you pass it on to something else. So these are networks of labor. Very decentralized labor, and so this has been very traditional, and this the book shows is linked to Indian philosophy, which works its way into the structure of society. Now, this is very hard to control. So even after, you know, several centuries of Islamic rule in India, which was very centrally controlled, and a few centuries of British rule, which was also very centrally controlled, it created a upper strata, westernized, organized, you know, corporate type of people. And I was raised in my family with such people, so I understand it well. But a huge strata, a huge number of Indians living outside the three or four large metros, in the rural areas, in smaller towns, living a more traditional lifestyle, they are still part of a very decentralized organization. And this is why you find an sort of an infinite variety of ethnicities and large variety of languages and cultures and cuisines and dresses and fashions and creative art, because this decentralization is very fertile for creativity. And very, it is sort of, it will boggle the mind of somebody who comes from a very structured, orderly place. And such a person may quickly think that India is disorder, chaos, anarchical, you know, unpredictable. And that's because the decentralized organization is vastly more complex to understand, because there's so many different things happening, and they're not all lookalikes of each other. Each one of them is very, very different. Now, the term that the Indian government started using, because the Indian government inherited a very British style of thinking, and the Indian constitution is a very Western style of organization, which is now being challenged by a lot of people. The term that the Indian authorities started using was, there is an organized sector, which is sort of good news, we are developed, and then there is the disorganized sector, which meant the traditional Indian way of life. And then later, the term disorganized was replaced by the term unorganized, sort of like little less, you know, hurtful, little less kind of damaging and insulting. I don't like to call it unorganized. I like to call it self-organized. And to me, the opposite of centrally organized is not disorganized or unorganized, but self-organized. Self-organized is related to the fact that I, as a person, am complete, I'm divine, I'm empowered, I want to self-actualize, and therefore, when I meet you and others, I find the same in you, and we are self-organized to conduct ourselves in a certain way. And this is very organic. Cells are self-organized. Plants are self-organized. The different cells in a plant don't have a headquarters. There is no central place from where they get directives and all that. Even the physiology of the human body, it was incorrectly assumed that the brain is the CPU, but now they're finding that the digestive system, the heart, I mean, if you look at the distribution of intelligence all over the human body, the new physiology that's being discovered is more and more decentralized. So decentralized systems exist in nature. All of the cosmos is highly decentralized because the ultimate reality, the divine, is involuted, is embedded in every individual electron, every individual particle, every individual ant and insect and bacteria and every cloud and every tree. So therefore, it is not a problem that intelligence is decentralized because that is the very nature of what the cosmos is. So you see, to the Indian traditional mind, the decentralized society is not some kind of an anomaly, not some kind of a problem that we have to fix by developing these people and getting them organized in a central way.
Well, you're actually speaking to where I was opening here, to the nature of it. There's an interdependent and there's a unity in that decentralization. That harmonic that's actually created in that self-organizing way. That's exactly where we were leaving our discussion a week ago, as potentially the antidote to this corporatization of the world and this power over kind of dynamism that's really happened with the way that the markets and the financial system have been overtaken in that way, with this sense of control and domination and centralization. Yes. You just paint an interesting picture, Rajiv, in a very practical way of what I think those of us around the world who are looking for inspiration might even be pointing to learn more from.
And, you know, there are implications regarding consumerism, which we can continue at some point, why it's not viable, why with such a huge population we cannot all become the American ideal lifestyle. It's just not achievable. And this idea of decentralization also includes self-actualization. So the resources in the tradition that allow me to find bliss and or what we call anand or inner joy without dependence on external things that I have to go and buy, without dependence on what the advertisers are wanting me to buy, without this whole economy of obsolescence where things have gone out of fashion and I should do what the neighbors are doing or what the TV is telling me to do, but looking inside for joy my own way and without dependence on physical things. That whole philosophy of not being consumerist comes out of all this.
Well, it comes out of just where you were describing the difference about something that's inner-oriented with the direct contact with reality, direct contact with what is emerging out of reality, the many, many facets of essence that we are that are really illuminating our lives, as you're describing, with a sense of joy and pleasure and fulfillment that's different than the externalized realization we get from buying something that gives that in place of what's already inside. That's a big distinction that we can be thinking about moving toward, too.
Yes.
Rajiv, I know we're getting down into probably the latter parts and minutes of our show here. I do want to continue this conversation. I clearly invite you back to this. But for our guests here or for our listeners, how will they continue? How can they access you on the web and access the book?
Could I give the website of the book and how to buy it?
Yes, please.
Sure. It's www.beingdifferentbook.com. So the title of the book is Being Different, and we've added book after it. So it's beingdifferentbook.com. And when you go there, there's a tab called Videos, and there's about 30, 40 different events, discussions in the public square and also discussions in the academia. And all of my talks and question answers and debates and all of that are available in video form. You can watch 100 hours of video about this book. You can also click something called Join the Discussion, and we have almost 3,000 people who are members of an online discussion group on Yahoo, and you can join that. On the right margin of the home page, there's a way to click and buy the book for $19. So it's a pretty comprehensive website, and I hope to add this radio interview there as well.
Well, it's wonderful, and I know that you had been doing so much work and so many presentations and speeches and introducing the book in India, and I think this is merely more of an early entree here in the United States, and we're pleased here on Zoom and Voice America to have you as a early foray into that in addition to all of what you've got going on the web. And I'm serious about this, Reggie. We'd love to have you back. We have much more to talk about, some of the nature of the differences and how here in the West we need to and can benefit by understanding and expanding the way that we actually engage the world, understanding our anxiety over chaos, understand, as you were describing, the comfort with complexity. Many, many, many facets we can talk about on this. But let me turn it to you for the last, say, 30 seconds here. One final thought that would be useful to keep in mind as we're considering our own place in this world, especially in a power over kind of a dynamic and an economy and a financial world that has this Western universalism to it. Final thought for the day.
Yeah, I would be delighted to come back because I think it's been a very interesting and stimulating conversation. I thank you for that. And I would like to just leave with the thought that we should question the notion of a historical identity, because the historical identity puts me in bondage, and the historical identity leads to this business about somebody thinks their ancestors were oppressed by the other people's ancestors, so there is an animosity or a tension. We have to let go of that. In the present moment, we are who we are, and we are not prisoners of some old historical things. We are endowed with infinite power right now to free ourselves, liberate ourselves from that condition. And that is the path of spirituality, which I feel has a huge potential, not only for the individual in their inner journey, but also collectively for humanity as a whole, so we can transcend all these borders and all this divisiveness.
Wonderful, Rajiv. Wonderful thought to end with, and I'll add to it, it feels to me like what you're describing as our own realization as leaders, whatever that domain we're living in, and living our realization, actualizing it in the world, bringing the sense of freedom to the world, the nature of the change that we need. Folks, wonderful to be with you this week. Rajiv, again, thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to the next time so we can continue the conversation. But folks, as always, from here in the Rocky Mountains and the beautiful view of the snow-capped peaks, enjoy, find that inner expression and joy within, and combine it with that love of what you see outside. Have a great week, folks. Enjoy. Back again next week. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.